Good evening, everyone. I'm Michael Myers, Professor of Philosophy here at Washington State University. I will serve as your moderator tonight. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to you tonight for tonight's debate on the existence of God. We would like to thank our sponsors, the Center for Inquiry and the Secular Student Alliance. Speaking of applause, I would ask that the audience applaud twice only more during the debate. The first opportunity for applause will be after I introduce the speakers. The second time will be at the end of the debate. Please do not applaud or express reactions during the course of the debate so that we can appraise the two speakers' remarks rationally and in a safe environment. The debate will open with two 20-minute statements, one by each speaker. Each speaker will then have a 10-minute rebuttal. The next part will be a cross-examination period where each speaker will have the opportunity to ask each other three questions and give a response. During this part, you, the members of the audience, may, if you wish, jot down a question on the card under your seat. Please direct the question specifically to one or the other of the speakers, although the one not addressed will have a chance to respond. Pass your cards to the left. They will be collected and given to me. The third part of the debate will consist of me asking the speakers questions from the audience and them both having the chance to respond. Finally, the speakers will have a 12-minute closing statement. After that, I will ask for applause. Now, let's introduce our speakers. Dr. Phil Fernandez is the president of the Institute of Biblical Defense, which he founded in 1990 to teach Christians how to defend the Christian faith. He is the pastor of Trinity Bible Fellowship in Bremerton, Washington, and teaches at Columbia Evangelical Seminary, the Imago Dei Institute, and King's West School. He earned a PhD from Greenwich University, an MA from Liberty University, and a Master of Theology degree from Columbia Evangelical Seminary. Dr. Fernandez has publicly debated leading atheists in defense of Christianity at universities such as Princeton and North Carolina Chapel Hill. He is a member of four professional societies, the Evangelical Theological Society, the Evangelical Philosophical Society, the International Society of Christian Apologetics, and the Society of Christian Philosophers. He has authored several books, of which the most recent is The Atheist Delusion, A Christian Response to Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins. Mr. Eddie Tavash is a constitutional lawyer in Beverly Hills, California. He graduated magna cum laude from UCLA in 1973 and from Loyola Law School of Los Angeles in 1976. He is a member of the board of directors of the Center for Inquiry Transnational and its subsidiary, the Council for Secular Humanism. He chairs the Center for Inquiry, Los Angeles. His father was an ordained Orthodox rabbi from one of the most respected pre-World War II rabbinical seminaries in Lithuania. His mother was an Auschwitz survivor from Hungary. After decades of spiritual seeking, he has concluded that we live in a natural universe with no supernatural agencies or occurrences. Edward Tabash has debated such prominent Christian philosophers as Peter Van Inwagen, William Lane Craig, Douglas Guyvet, Richard Swinburne, and now Phil Fernandez. In this debate, he is formally representing the Center for Inquiry and the Council for Secular Humanism. Thank you. And please remember to save your applause till the end from now on. So now we will have Dr. Fernandez with the 20-minute opening statement.
Well, it's great to be here. I'm from right now. I'm from Western Washington, so it's nice to drive across, come out here to Eastern Washington. It's great to be here. Last time I spoke in Eastern Washington, they paid me $500 to stop talking. So hopefully things will go a little better tonight. I'd like to thank Nick Conrad for promoting this debate, and Attorney Eddie Tabash for agreeing to debate me. I hope to be a worthy opponent tonight. I'd also like to say hello to Jeff Lauder, a good friend of mine. I haven't seen him for a decade. But hopefully I'll be a worthy opponent. Now, my case for the existence of a personal infinite God does not rest on the validity of one sole argument. Instead, I have chosen to utilize the cumulative case for God. This cumulative case will examine seven different aspects of human experience that are more adequately explained by theism, the belief in a personal God, than by atheism, the rejection of the belief in a personal God. The thesis I seek to defend is as follows. It is more reasonable to be a theist than it is to be an atheist. Number one, the beginning of the universe. Before the 20th century, atheists argued that the universe was eternal. Therefore, it did not need a cause. But now the vast majority of atheist thinkers acknowledge that the universe had a beginning. Scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe includes the second law of thermodynamics called energy deterioration and the Big Bang model. The second law of thermodynamics states that the amount of usable energy in a closed system is running down. This means that someday in the finite future, all the energy in the universe will be useless unless there is intervention from outside the universe. In other words, if left to itself, the universe will have an end. But if the universe is going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. At one time in the finite past, all the energy in the universe was usable. Since the universe is winding down, it must have been wound up. The universe is not eternal. It had a beginning. Since it had a beginning, it needs a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. It should also be noted that due to energy deterioration, if the universe is eternal, it would have reached a state of equilibrium in which no change is possible an infinite amount of time ago. All the universe's energy would have already been used up. Obviously, this is not the case. Therefore, the universe had a beginning. The Big Bang model also indicates that the universe had a beginning. In 1929, astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding at the same rate in all directions as we move forward in time. But this means that if we go back in time, the physical universe will get smaller and smaller. Eventually, if we go back far enough into the past, the entire universe would not exist. Therefore, if the Big Bang model is correct, it shows that the universe began to exist out of nothing a finite time ago. Non-being cannot cause being. If the universe had a beginning, then it needs a cause. Besides the scientific evidence, there is also philosophical evidence for the beginning of the universe. If the universe is eternal, then there would be an actual infinite number of events in time. However, it is impossible to traverse an actual infinite set of points. If the universe is eternal, then there must exist an actual infinite set of events in the past, but then it would be impossible to reach the present moment. Since the present moment has been reached, there cannot be an actual infinite set of events in the past. There could only be a finite number. Therefore, there had to be a first event. Hence, the universe had a beginning. Since the universe had to have a beginning, it had to have a cause, for from nothing, nothing comes. But if the universe needs a cause, what if the cause of the universe also needs a cause? Could we not have an infinite chain of causes and effects stretching backwards in time throughout all eternity? Obviously, the answer is no, for we have already shown that an actual infinite regress is impossible. Therefore, an infinite chain of causes and effects is impossible. There had to be a first uncaused cause of the universe. This uncaused cause would be eternal without beginning and end. Only eternal and uncaused existence can ground the existence of the universe. Number two, the design and order found in the universe. The order, design, and complexity found in the universe strongly imply that the universe is not a random, chaotic throwing together of atoms. Rather, it is the product of intelligent design. And as the product of intelligent design, it necessitates the existence of an intelligent designer. Contemporary scientists have found numerous evidences for the design in the universe. A few examples will suffice. First, the slightest variation in the expansion rate of the universe would render the universe incapable of sustaining life. Second, British scientists Hoyle and Wickramasinghe estimated that the chances of life evolving from the random shuffling of organic molecules is virtually zero. They calculated that there is only one chance in 10 to the 20th power to form a single enzyme, and just one chance in 10 to the 40,000th power to produce the approximately 2,000 enzymes that exist. However, Hoyle and Wickramasinghe point out that the production of enzymes is only one step in the generation of life. Therefore, they concluded that there must be some type of cosmic intelligence to explain the origin of life. Hoyle compared the probability of life spontaneously generating from non-life as equivalent to the chances of a tornado producing a Boeing 747 from a junkyard. The cell is the basic unit of life. The DNA molecule of a single-celled animal contains enough complex information to fill 1,000 sets of encyclopedia. An explosion in a print shop will never produce 1,000 sets of encyclopedia. That amount of information necessitates an intelligent cause. Also, the human brain contains more genetic information than the world's largest libraries. There is no way that this amount of information could be produced by mere chance. Intelligent intervention is needed. Third, astrophysicist Hugh Ross has listed 25 narrowly defined parameters that the universe had to have in order for life to be possible. Ross also pointed out 32 narrowly defined parameters for life concerning the Earth, its moon, its sun, and its galaxy. For instance, if the distance between the Earth and the sun was to differ by just 2% in either direction, no life on Earth would be possible. These parameters for life on Earth clearly show evidence of design and purpose. The theistic hypothesis of intelligent design is obviously more plausible than the atheistic hypothesis of random chance. Number three, the validity of human reason and the intelligibility of the universe. It seems to me that only theism, the belief in a personal God, justifies the possibility of human knowledge. Atheism offers no good reason for the validity of human reason and the intelligibility of the universe. However, theism entails the doctrine that a rational God created man in his image as a rational being and a coherent universe so that through reason man could find out about the universe in which he lives. Remove the rational God of theism from the equation, and the basis for human knowledge appears to crumble. Number four, the existence of absolute moral values. We all make moral value judgments when we call the actions of another person wrong. When we do this, we appeal to a moral law. This moral law could not originate with each individual, for then we could not call the actions of another person, such as Adolf Hitler, wrong. The moral law is not the creation of each society, for then one society cannot condemn the actions of another society, such as Nazi Germany or the Taliban. The moral law does not come from a world consensus, for world consensus is often mistaken. The world once thought that the earth was flat, the sun revolved around the earth, and slavery was morally acceptable. So the moral consensus has been long wrong in the past, what makes us think that it's going to be right now. Appealing to society or world consensus will never give us an adequate cause for the moral law and the moral judgments we make. Appealing to society or world consensus only quantitatively adds men and women. What we need is a moral law qualitatively above man. This moral law must be eternal and unchanging so that we can condemn the actions of the past by this standard. The moral law qualitatively above man is not descriptive of the way things are, as is the case with natural laws. Instead, the moral law must be prescriptive. It prescribes the way things ought to be. Prescriptive laws need a prescriber. Therefore, a moral lawgiver must exist, and this moral lawgiver must be eternal and unchanging. Number five, the absurdity of life without God. Each of us thirsts for something more. Life on earth never fully satisfies. It is my contention that only the God of the Bible can fully satisfy man's deepest needs. What hope can an atheist offer mankind? People on their deathbeds don't usually call an atheist to comfort them. Normally a preacher or a priest is summoned. Even if an atheist could guarantee us 70 years of happiness, what good would that be when compared with the eternity of non-existence that follows? If there is no God who sits enthroned, then Hitler will not be punished for his evil deeds, and Corrie Ten Boom will not be rewarded for risking her life to save innocent people. If there is no God, then a million years from now, what would it matter if you were a Hitler or a Corrie Ten Boom? What difference would it make? Does life have any ultimate meaning if there is no God? If non-existence is what awaits us, can we really make sense of life? You live, and then you die. There are no eternal consequences. Hitler and Corrie Ten Boom have the same destiny. We all finish our meaningless journeys in total nothingness. Everything we build will be torn down. Everything we accomplish will be reduced to rubble and the death of the universe. Without God, life is without meaning. Without God, life is absurd. However, if there is a God, then there is hope. The God of the Bible guarantees the defeat of evil and the triumph of good. He guarantees that Hitler will receive his punishment and Corrie Ten Boom will receive her reward. God gives life meaning, for how we choose to live our lives on earth brings eternal consequences. God is our reason to be optimistic about the future. Only He can overcome our fear of death. Only He can defeat evil. Without God, meaningless existence is all we face. Without God, there is no hope. Number six, human rights and respect for human life. If atheism is true, then man is mere molecules in motion. He has no greater value than the animals. In fact, human life would be no more sacred than the existence of a rock. Yet we act as if human life has more value than the life of animals or the existence of rocks. If the material universe is all there is, then man is just a material part of the universe. There seems to be no basis from which to argue for human rights or the sanctity of human life. Even our founding fathers, who were not always consistent with their ideals, grounded their view of inalienable rights in their belief that all men are created equal. I propose that the most reasonable explanation for our common conception of human rights is the biblical teaching that human life has value since we were created in God's image. Number seven, human free will and responsibility. If atheism is true, then it makes sense that the material world is all that exists. Non-material entities are rather strange furniture for a universe void of God. The physical realm would be all that exists. This would mean that humans do not have immaterial souls. Our choices would not really be free choices. Instead, our decisions would merely be chemical reactions occurring in our brains. But if this is the case, then our choices are biologically determined. We are not free to choose our actions. If atheistic materialism is true, then we could not hold people responsible for their actions. Someone's brain makes them serve others. Another person's brain makes them slaughter others. Neither person is responsible for their choices or actions. If atheists really believe that their worldview is correct, then they should fight to close down prisons and set the prisoners free. For if human free will is an illusion, and consistent atheists like B.F. Skinner believe that it is, then criminals are not responsible for their actions and therefore should not be punished for their actions. But most atheists want to see criminals behind bars. They live like theism, the belief in God, they live like theism is true. They live like man is free and he is responsible for the choices he makes. Again, the theistic explanation is more plausible than the attempted atheistic explanation. So in conclusion, I'd like to state a few things. In the famous debate on the existence of God between Bertrand Russell and Frederick Copleston, the atheist Bertrand Russell stated concerning the existence of the universe, "I should say that the universe is just there, and that's all." It is my contention that atheism fails as an explanation of significant aspects of human experience, and that theism is a more reasonable hypothesis. If the atheist could say that the universe is just there, could he not say that moral values, design and order, human rights, and the possibility of human knowledge and meaning in life are just there as well? To avoid looking for an explanation is not the same thing as the search for an explanation. In this sense, the theistic explanation is superior to the atheistic explanation, for the latter, atheism, reduces to a non-explanation. However, the atheist may choose to deny the reality of moral values, design and order, any basis for human rights, the possibility of human knowledge, and meaning in life. If the atheist takes this strategy, my response is that he cannot live consistently with the view that these things are not real. Even the atheist lives as if some things are wrong and other things are right. Listen closely when Eddie Tabash speaks. He'll be condemning, and rightfully so, some of the evils done throughout history. But where is the basis for that in atheism? So even the atheist lives as if some things are wrong and other things are right. He lives as if human life is sacred and life has meaning. Rational statements only make sense within some type of rational context. The atheist, by arguing against God's existence, has removed the rational context for rational discourse. He reasons against God, but if there is no God, there's no basis for human reason. Is it reasonable to believe that the universe popped into existence out of absolute nothingness, entirely without a cause? Is the atheist justified in holding to the idea that time plus chance plus natural laws worked upon primordial soup until it eventually birthed a French philosopher who declared, "I think, therefore I am"? Obviously, the answer is no. From molecules of motion will never come moral values or the laws of logic. From a mound of dirt, a single thought will never be produced, no matter how much time is given. If no God exists and all we are is molecules in motion, from whence come human rights? If an innocent child is merely a random collection of atoms, can we really say that it is wrong to crush him? If there is no life after death, and all we face is everlasting extinction, can this life really have meaning? What counsel can an atheist offer a suffering friend on his deathbed? Can we climb above despair if all we face is extinction? When the universe dies, all die with it. If atheism is true, then human experience is a cruel joke. For these reasons, I believe, these seven reasons that I pointed out, beginning of the universe, design in the universe, moral laws, human rights, human free will, meaning in life, the validity of human reason and the intelligibility of the universe. For these reasons, I believe that the theistic explanation is far superior to the atheistic explanation. Theism is more reasonable than atheism. Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you, Dr. Fernandez. Mr. Tabash?
Good evening. I want to thank Nick for putting on this debate, and I want to thank my friend, the sincere Christian and tough-as-nails ex-Marine Phil Fernandez, for finally debating me after 10 years of us eyeing each other and wanting to tangle. I'm going to argue that the evidence in our physical universe makes it much more likely than not that a supernatural, self-conscious personality that is the all-good, all-knowing, and all-powerful deity, the standard-issue God of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, does not exist. There is no evidence of any supernatural event outside of wishful thinking, no evidence that has ever been adduced in human history. Also, the weight of the evidence in accumulation, and here's where Phil and I mirror each other because we're making cumulative arguments, shows that in our physical universe, atheism is the best inference to be made from the existing evidence. Now, if I told all of you that 2,000 years ago here in ancient Pullman, green gremlins from the sixth dimension abducted members of the native population and imbued them with special powers, and these people are now the guardian angels of the United States, you wouldn't believe me because this type of thing violates the laws of nature. If I said I flew here from Los Angeles by flapping my arms, not by way of airplane, you wouldn't believe me because your prior experience in the physical world shows you these things are not probable, and the burden of proof would be on me to demonstrate they are if I assert something that is paranormal and beyond your everyday experience. Now, the same problem of the supernatural generally becomes more specifically defined in the area of miracles. Claims of miracles have the initial problem of bearing witness against themselves because they are violations of the very laws of nature that are not supposed to be violated. Now, all the supposed miracles that are used to verify the intervention in human affairs of a deity took place in a pre-scientific era. That's suspect. Why not today? Why don't we moderns have the same opportunity to observe these things? Talking snakes, talking donkeys, worldwide floods, sun standing still, people being turned into pillars of salt, people resurrecting. None of this. Now, if in fact there is no reason to show us miracles, why, for instance, did God harden Pharaoh's heart supposedly in the Bible just so that he could show his miracles to the Israelites and the Egyptians? There is no verifiable event in today's world that corresponds to these types of biblical miracles. If a deity was going to part the Red Sea to get ancient Israelites away from Pharaoh, shouldn't that same deity perform miracles in the 1940s to stop a much more deadly enemy of the descendants of those Israelites in the concentration camps? If we look in Lake Loch Ness in Scotland for the supposed sea serpent and don't find it, we have a right to conclude, unless there is contrary evidence, that it's not there. If you look and do not find, you are justified in concluding that it's not there. Now, before we can have life after death, which is something we would expect on a God, because if there is a God and he does not give us life after death, then he would not be that relevant to our existence. We have to first make sure that we survive the death of our brains in the first place. But let's look at that. Everything we know about ourselves, everything that we understand, has come about by sensory input into the human brain. So if a two-month-old child dies, does that child pop out into the hereafter as a fully formed person speaking a language? If somebody is 70 years old and has never heard the sound of human voice, when they die, do the angels speak a language to them that they have never heard before? Our self-awareness is shaped by interactions with others and the use of language resulting from sensory input into our brains. Also, in the after-death state, do we still see things if we have no eyes? if there is no corporeal physical body to the soul, how is one soul distinguished from others? Are we packets of lights just floating around? And how do we distinguish each other? How do we communicate with each other? Also, if in fact there is life after death, and if there is the capacity for physical conscious awareness without the physical brain, how come all the evidence demonstrates that you can't have conscious self-awareness unless you have a physical brain with functional cortical neurons and synapses? If it were true, then a blow on the head would not eclipse consciousness. If it were true, an anesthetic would not eclipse consciousness. If it were true, then Alzheimer's disease would not result in the total effacing of conscious self-awareness. So to argue that there's life after death, you have to say, destroy a quarter of my brain, you've destroyed a quarter of my consciousness. Destroy 50% of my brain, you've destroyed 50% of my consciousness, but destroy 100% of my brain, and I reconstitute in a non-physical realm, being fully myself. How does that work? If we die right now, do we look down on our bodies? What do we use for eyes? How does our self-awareness hang together without a physical brain? When they do brain surgery, if they remove certain parts of the brain, entire areas of memory are destroyed. Well, then if they destroy the entire brain, how come all of memory isn't destroyed? So the mechanism of survival of consciousness after death seems highly unlikely. What is the mechanism by which it holds together? Neuroscience has taught us that nothing mental happens without a corresponding physical event in the brain. Also, not only does this argument cut against life after death as an atheological argument, it also makes God's existence unlikely because we have no experience of conscious self-awareness manifesting in a being without a physical brain, without cortical neurons and synapses. So how does God think without a physical brain? How does God say, I will do this rather than that? I am God. I'm separate from my creatures. How does God have cognitive self-awareness without cortical neuron synapses and a physical brain? Then there is the problem from evil, which I will define as pointless suffering. Now, God can make whatever he wants to happen, so why natural disasters? If suffering is a warning from God, how come there is no explanation when it occurs? Now, Phil has written on page 123 of his book, The God Who Sits Enthroned, that the Christian apologist must defend the reality of evil without proposing evil as eternal or as a creation of God. Well, God is fighting Phil hard on this point because in Isaiah 45:7, God says, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. So why is one child born in a Bangladesh mud hut and the other born in some mansion? The burden of proof is on the theist to show that evil is not a fatal flaw in claiming there's an all-good, all-knowing, all-powerful God. Now, even if we need discipline, we could use a military boot camp. We don't need concentration camps. For instance, and this also gets into the argument from design, malaria is a terrible disease. There is a gene, though, that provides an effective defense against malaria. It works by destroying any red blood corpuscles that have been occupied by any of the types of parasitic protozoans that cause malaria. But if one has inherited this gene from both parents, the result is sickle cell anemia. So who designed that system? Why do we need the Ebola virus or certain cancers that eat people up alive? Where is the explanation? And if God wants us to believe in him, how come he's not forthcoming with the explanation? Why do we need poisonous insects? Why do we need poisonous snakes? Now, God does not adequately comfort suffering, so God would be way too harsh with us. The distribution of disease and pain is in no way related to the virtue of the afflicted. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the worst calamities befall only bad people. Our daily world shows us every day that good people can suffer horrendously and frequently do, maybe even more than bad people. How does this come about? Also, if God is all-knowing and unchanging with his respect to his views on evil, if he changes his mind, how does that comport with his being all-knowing? In Exodus 32:14, and the Lord repented of the evil which he sought to do unto his people. Think about that. If God repented of his evil, it means he changed his mind, which means he was not all-knowing from eternity because he changed his mind. So that means he did not know what he was going to do because he changed his mind. And if he knew he was going to change his mind, that becomes meaningless because then he never intended to do the evil because he knew he would repent. So you can't have it both ways. Also, the flourishing and languishing of sentient beings is not something we would expect on theism. We have only a few decades of good health and particular vigor, and then the decline of illness and old age after a lifetime of hard work. Countless living organisms, including sentient beings, never flourish at all, and countless others flourish only briefly. And this would be very surprising if there were a God, but it's not surprising if the universe is natural and there is no God. Now, though many believers believe in evolution, ultimately, because of its sloppiness and trial and error features, it is much more likely on naturalism than it is on theism. More than 99% of all species that ever existed are now extinct. That would be quite wasteful. We have useless components in our bodies that indeed do more harm than good, like the appendix, known to most people only when they're about to burst. So evolution by natural selection is established by the weight of the evidence thus far in our world. For instance, there's a 100% match of DNA sequences in the pseudo region of the beta globin, and that is proof that humans and gorillas share a relatively recent common ancestor. So the groping in the dark, the trial and error, the wastefulness of evolution is more likely on atheism than it is on theism. And then we have the question of divine hiddenness, which could also be called the issue of silence, God's silence. Why is there reasonable non-belief? If we had a debate tonight on whether there's gravity, none of you would have shown up. The fact that we can debate seriously God's existence shows that it's reasonable to be a non-believer. So why does God play hide-and-seek with his own children? God didn't comfort my paternal grandmother as the Nazis were about to shoot her into a pit. God didn't comfort my maternal grandfather when he was about to be shoved into the gas chamber at Auschwitz. God didn't comfort my mother when the Gestapo told her that her father and her brother were just gassed and burned. So God didn't appear and said, don't worry, I'll make it all right in the end. And so how come God is only available to us by ancient hearsay and is not directly communicative? For instance, if right now my dead father came in here and in his inimitable Yiddish accent said, Eddie, why are you debating the Christian guy? Get back to your office and work. I'd say, wait a minute, Phil might have a point about life after death. If Phil and I were levitated to the ceiling right now and there were no wires, I might say something is going on. If this podium were transformed into purple mist, I might say something. But also, why are there so many different religions? Why doesn't God issue a simulcast in every language letting us know which is true and which is not true? And so only the ironclad predictable laws of nature that betray no actual evidence of the supernatural are there. Because if, in fact, there were a supernatural, we would be able to detect it. Right now, all we can detect are naturalistic occurrences or inferences that are still naturalistic. such as dark matter and dark energy. Also, if the universe were so finely tuned, how come the overwhelming majority of it is lethal? It's estimated that 96% of the universe is made up of unsurvivable dark energy and dark matter, and that the universe, according to many physicists, is more hospitable for black holes than for us. There's lethal radiation everywhere. There's chaotic destruction of stars. So where is this wonderful design? Where is this fine-tuning for the universe to be so hospitable to life outside of our small little corner and small little region in a very remote part of the universe? Why does God make belief in him so difficult by putting forth such a hard-to-believe Bible? For instance, it says that the earth was created before the stars in the book of Genesis. We know that's not true because stars have to explode first as a supernova, and then their debris becomes planets. So the planet Earth could not have been formed before the stars. That's just one of many, many defects. Also, Genesis implies the stars are fixed to a firmament, but we know that's not true. We know the universe is expanding. So this leads to the argument from confusion. Not only do people disagree about religions, people disagree within religions. And this also questions the objectivity of moral values, because if there is a God who wants us to know which religion is true, he would not only let us know which theology is true, he'd let us know which moral values are true. Many Christians disagree on questions of capital punishment, abortion, gay rights, euthanasia, gun possession, war and peace, the rights of women. When we even had the dispute over the Equal Rights Amendment, we had groups of Christians warring with each other about the role of women. So which is it? Also, from the argument from religious confusion, why does God allow the yogis of India and Tibetan Buddhists who meditate with the greatest sincerity to come back with the notion that the universe is run by some great cosmic mush, and then a Christian goes into prayer and comes out and says, no, the universe is run by a God who will send you to hell if you don't believe a certain way? Why do Mormons have a different conception of God? Why do Muslims have a different perception of God? Why do the different branches of Judaism have a different perception of God? In the Jewish community I grew up in, there was a saying, if you have two Jews, you'll have 50 opinions. Well, how does that come about if there is a God that would want to give us a clear message as to what his word is? So, for instance, the Dalai Lama is no less sincere in his internal pleading investigation for whatever is ultimate truth to manifest to him, and yet after decades of meditation comes up with something different than what the Christian comes up with. Also, if in fact the universe is designed so well, how come everything is so precarious? The theists always say, well, if only this differed just a little bit, everything would collapse on itself. Why does God skate so close to the edges? So this is a conflict between the fine-tuning argument and aspect of the design argument. Yes, the universe is so magnificently designed, but if only one chemical or one constant changed, everything would fall apart. So it balances on a thread. This is why, if you take the totality of the evidence of our universe and you look at what we see, what we can infer, the totality of our experience makes it more likely than not that we live in a natural and not a supernatural universe, which means it is more likely than not that there is no God. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tabash. Okay, next we will have our two 10-minute periods for rebuttal. First 10-minute period, Dr. Fernandez.
I just want to say as I get started in this rebuttal period that I really think Eddie is a great guy, and I like the way he's handling this debate, that it's not a personal thing, which is really good, because I hope everybody's able to keep that separate, our ideas separate from the fact that, you know, I really love this guy, and I think he loves me, and I think Jeff could attest to that. Having said that, Eddie tells us that there's no evidence for God, okay? And I would still say that I don't think anything that I said in my opening statement has changed one bit. I don't really think he's went head-to-head, atheism versus theism, and shown where any one of the seven aspects that I pointed out where atheism is more reasonable. That's the beginning of the universe. Does he really want us to believe the universe popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause? I mean, nothing is nothing. As a philosopher, I can get paid for talking about nothing. Nothing is nothing, okay? Therefore, nothing can do nothing. Therefore, nothing can cause nothing. So if the universe had a beginning, something else had to cause it to come into existence. Non-being cannot cause being. For something to have power, the ability to do something like create, it has to be actual first. By definition, nothing is non-actual. Okay? So I don't even think his opening statement gets off the ground. This debate is not about the inerrancy of the Bible. He wants me to look into what exactly Isaiah meant. He wants me to talk about contradictions, supposed contradictions in the Bible. By the way, you've had brilliant men like Calvin, Luther, you've had Aquinas, who never saw these contradictions that guys like Eddie could just pick up on in a heartbeat. They just pick up the Bible, they close their eyes, they point at something, whoa, it's a contradiction. And all these brilliant minds for 2,000 years were never able to find these things. But this debate is not about the inerrancy of the Bible. This debate is about whether or not God exists. Okay? And so we're looking at, where's the evidence for atheism? I haven't seen any so far. And where are the refutation of my arguments? I haven't seen that as well. We have the beginning of the universe, the design in the universe, absolute moral laws, the absurdity of life without God, you know, meaning in life, the validity of human reason. He's using reason this whole debate, and he accepts science, so he believes the universe is intelligible. Where do you get that from atheism? Do you really think that we evolved, given enough time from dirt and a little bit of water, you're going to get human reason, right thinking? You're going to get absolute moral laws so we can condemn things like the Holocaust? There's something more going on in this world. You know, an atheist will show up at the philosophy lecture hall and say, you know, only material things exist, and then he goes home and he tells his wife, I love you, honey. When's the last time scientists put love in a test tube? Scientists are supposed to report their experiments honestly. Nobody ever put honesty in a test tube. How heavy is honesty? How far can you throw it? What color is it? Okay? These are non-material realities that cannot be explained adequately by atheism. Eddie talks as if the validity of human reason is a given. It's not. If atheism is true, it's not a given. In fact, it's a rather weird thing for an atheistic universe. He talks as if the reality of moral laws is a given. It's not. See, moral laws are prescriptive. They need a prescriber. Someone to say, thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that. If man is nothing but mere molecules in motion, then whatever is just is. Okay? So the validity of human reason, the reality of moral laws, are only givens if a rational moral God exists. Let's see, he explains design of the universe by random chance. He talks about parts of the universe that are not, don't show design. Maybe things are going wrong. He talks about our appendix and all and stuff. In the early 1960s, my old Jewish doctor, Dr. Altebaum, everybody thought I had so many sore throats, they need to yank out my tonsils. He said, he told my father, I said, Joe, don't do it. I don't want to do it because I'm reading some of the latest research. They're going to find out that there's a reason why tonsils get infected. I think the tonsils get infected to take the infection. There's a purpose for it. We think we know everything, but just give it some time. Sure enough, I found out I'm better off with my tonsils still there. So just because we don't know what the purpose is doesn't mean there isn't a purpose for it. We haven't figured everything out. We need a little bit of humility there. Having said that, just because you can show me that a car has a few parts that aren't working, that doesn't prove to me that the car wasn't designed by an intelligent being. So the existence of design in the universe, and he talks about, well, with the fine tuning of the universe, why would God walk so close to the edge on something like that? Is Eddie telling us he would believe in God if the way the universe was designed was the only way it could be designed? No, he'd say, well, there's no God. It couldn't be any other way. So, he wants it both ways there. Now, he's going to be bringing up evil a lot. And I think this is a legitimate gripe that he has, although I think that he needs a theistic basis for all the reasoning that he's doing. So to argue against God, you need something like the theistic God to ground the validity of your reason. So just the fact that he's reasoning proves my point, the whole debate anyway. But I think he's got a good point with evil. There's something there. Evil and human suffering, I just give you several thoughts on it. It allows people room for unbelief, room to reject God, but it also draws other people to God. I know there's some of the toughest points in my life that drew me to God. But the atheist wants to call evil, but there's a problem with evil for atheists. There's no way to call the world unjust unless one admits to a standard of justice outside and above the world. So when he calls the world unjust, I say, yes, it is, but we're both standing on Mount Sinai looking at the world. You need the theistic vantage point just to acknowledge that the world is unjust. Okay? Atheism has failed. The world's leading philosophers, Christian, theists, atheists agree that atheism has failed to show that God and evil are mutually exclusive. Okay? Because of this, atheists claim that it's the amount of evil in the world that disproves God's existence. But I would argue if we reduced human suffering to only one person, the atheists would still cry foul. And they'd say, how can God exist? Look at Joey. Okay? And I would feel bad for Joey, but whatever the case, so atheists want us to believe that they are so wise that they're able to comprehend all the possible reasons why an infinitely wise God might allow evil and human suffering and then judge them all as inadequate. Okay? I'm not arguing that I'm so wise I can explain why God allowed every individual case of evil. God's ways and his thoughts are far above ours. Whatever the case, if God removed all the bad choices we make, we would become robots. And then we'd complain. Well, we wouldn't complain. We'd be robots. If God removed the bad consequences of the bad choices, we wouldn't have the incentive to make things right and to turn back to him. I think that in the end, the real problem, evil is a real problem, and I think that in the end it gets outside the bounds of this debate, but in the end, the real solution to the real problem of evil is the Lord Jesus Christ, where God did something about the Holocaust. God did something about sin and evil, because God became one of us and was slaughtered on the cross of Calvary for our sins. And so I believe that ultimately, in the end, the Lord Jesus himself is the ultimate solution to the problem of evil. Having said that, his ways and his thoughts are far above ours as the heavens are above the earth, so we're never going to have them fully figured out. He talks about humans and gorillas being a lot alike. Yeah, there's a lot of differences too, but common anatomy, okay, could point to common design, not just necessarily common ancestry. Before we were here, we were drinking in a coffee shop, and a buddy of mine looked over and recognized what Gary Larson's drawings, just from the drawings before he even saw the name. He saw that common design can point to a common designer. And he talks about God's silence. Well, why is there reasonable non-belief? Well, and how come people can't find them when they're really looking? I would argue that they're not looking. That if you really do seek the true God and you're willing to surrender human autonomy and not be your own king so that you stand in judgment on God, if you're really seeking the true God, I believe you'll find him. This is what C.S. Lewis meant by the phrase God in the dock. It used to be that God stood in judgment on us. Then we gained our confidence, got arrogant, and now it is we, like Eddie Tabash, who try to stand in judgment on God. And I would argue it should not be that way.
Thank you, Dr. Fernandez. Mr. Tabash, your rebuttal, please.
can't even speak of a cause because there was no time and space for sequential causation to play out before the Big Bang occurred. So we don't know what happened there, but you can't fill in a God of the gaps because there was no sequential time and space. And all he does is to take it back further. He says you can't have an infinite regress, but then he has a God who for an eternity prior to making the universe said, I'm going to make the universe. So did God say, I'm going to have a infinite series of events between my first thought of making the universe and make the universe? So we don't understand how the universe came about, but we do know that it could not have had a sequential cause and effect as we understand cause and effect, because time and space, which is the platform for cause and effect, did not come about until the Big Bang. And he says, well, you can't have nothing from nothing, but that's exactly what he said his God did, was his God then made the universe out of nothing. So what did God have? Kind of like a cosmic spider web within himself, where out of that nothingness he can make a universe. That also breaks down. Now, he talked about the tornado making a 747. But that's not what we're saying by evolution on natural selection. We're not saying that out of nowhere there spontaneously appeared a 747, a human being. We're talking about millions and millions of years of trial and error. We're talking about a gradual process building on itself, natural selection. That's not the same as a spontaneous appearance of a fully formed, complex individual. And he was, again, speaking about his life after death. But he didn't refute my arguments as to the improbability of consciousness existing without a physical brain. He never gave us the mechanism by which conscious self-awareness, which is so obviously dependent on the physical brain, can survive the death of the physical brain. He never talked about that. Now, he said that this debate was not about the God of the Bible, but in numerous times in his opening statement, he mentioned the God of the Bible. He can't have it both ways. If he mentions the God of the Bible, then the God of the Bible is in play, and the inerrancy of the Bible, all its scientific errors, all its contradictions, all of its cruelties become an issue. In fact, even if Phil didn't mention the Bible, all of these things come into play, because an argument against God's existence is if there is a God, we would expect that he would give us a reliable revelation. If he fails to give us a reliable revelation, one that is not without flaws, that is an argument against his existence. Now, he says we cannot explain our reason on atheism, but yes, we can, because our day-to-day experience of the physical universe shows that we have reason and we can empirically determine things like the fact that we live in a physical universe. Phil didn't demonstrate how our capacity to think within our physical brains must have a platform of an underlying supernatural cause. He never demonstrated how that happens. He talked about absolute moral values, and he said, well, we used to approve of slavery. Well, it's the God of the Bible, the very Bible that he started to refer to, who approved slavery. St. Paul told the slaves to obey their masters. And in the Old Testament, you could be sold into slavery. So slavery was approved of in the Bible. And there is a preacher I've debated 7 miles from here, Doug Wilson, who has even written tracts that support this view, that it was supported in the Bible. So he talked about the God of the Bible again in his rebuttal and says that how will Hitler be punished without the God of the Bible? But you see, if you take the God of the Bible as Phil interprets him, there's a bad trick there. If you take Phil's God of the Bible, my mother, the Auschwitz survivor, who died in 1985, is now in hell because she didn't accept Jesus. And if any of the Nazis accepted Jesus before dying and made a sincere conversion, they would be in heaven. So the problem is that the God of the Bible is presiding over something worse than Auschwitz, because Auschwitz only lasted a few years, but the penalty for good people who just happen to pick the wrong theology is an eternal Auschwitz. And if Phil wants to say that's not part of the debate, he shouldn't have referred at all to the God of the Bible. He talks about human rights. Well, where in the Bible does it talk about equality? Where does it talk about democracy? Where does it talk about the rights of the individual? Where does it talk about other than theocratic government? Where does it talk about the equality of women? Throughout the Bible, talk about human rights. What about the rights of women? Throughout the Bible that Phil mentioned first in his opening statement, you have women absolutely subordinate to men. In Genesis 3:16, and then in the New Testament, the woman shouldn't speak in the church. And she was the one deceived. Eve was deceived, not Adam. And let her be in silence and submit to her husband in both testaments. Where is the human rights aspect of that? And then he talks about free will. Well, what makes us think by our empirical investigation of our physical world, by what we see, what makes us think that there has to be a supernatural underpinning of our minds for us to have free choice? Even if it's the result of a chemical process, while our brains are functioning, we have free choice. Because I can absolutely choose to put my hand here or here. But that does not change just because when I die, my consciousness will cease. So how does Phil demonstrate that our volition while we are alive is an illusion because we are annihilated at death? That simply doesn't follow. Now, he talks about moral values. Moral values aren't dependent on God because whether or not there is a God, just like the laws of logic don't depend on God, whether or not there is a God, 2 and 2 equals 4. Rape would be wrong whether or not there is a God. In fact, once again, referring to Phil's God of the Bible, where he commissions rape. He tells Moses' army, you're supposed to kill the non-virgins and keep the virgins for yourself. What is that if not rape? And so Phil says, well, how do we condemn crushing an innocent child without God? Well, he talks about the God of the Bible, and I would say, Phil, ask your God of the Bible how he justified crushing innocent children in the flood, where only 8 people were left alive. Ask your God how he justified in 1 Samuel the killing of every child, innocent child of the Amalekites. And so, once again, he said we have despair if there is no God. He says we have despair. Okay. That doesn't prove God's existence. I admit that on many levels, that the fact that there is no God means that ultimately Hitler and Martin Luther King will face the same annihilation. But that doesn't mean God springs into being to rescue us from that existential sadness. What you would expect on naturalism is that there is no ultimate justice, but our lives are still meaningful. My life is meaningful even though I'm 58 years old, and in a few more decades, I'll be gone. My doing this debate tonight is no less meaningful just because I'm going to be dead when many of you are still thriving in your careers. And then Phil says that the only solution is Jesus, but he says that's not part of the debate, but he brings it up anyway. Well, if the only solution is Jesus, then the argument from religious confusion says, how come my father, the sincere Orthodox rabbi, didn't come to Jesus? How come the Buddhist monk didn't come to Jesus? How come the yogi doesn't come to Jesus? No. The totality of the evidence makes it more likely than not that there is no God.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tabash. Oh, everyone, I guess we can take a breath. Very fine speakers tonight. Now, I would like to remind the audience that if you wish to ask a question of one of the speakers, that you write it down on the card under your seat and pass it all the way to your left for collection. And the collectors, please stand by to collect those cards. Okay, everyone, shall we get started on the second part of the evening? Now, this is going to be a cross-examination type affair here. And first, Mr. Tabash is going to ask Dr. Fernandez a question. He has 1 minute to frame the question. And then Dr. Fernandez has 2 minutes to respond. That will happen three times. So Mr. Tabash will ask Dr. Fernandez a total of three questions. Then we'll work it the other way, and Dr. Fernandez will ask Mr. Tabash a series of three questions, each 1 minute to formulate the question and 2 minute response. After that, I'll ask each one the questions that you all came up with. So, Mr. Tabash, please ask Dr. Fernandez your first question, and we'll need both speakers then at the podium for this section. Yeah.
Now, Phil, on page 147 of your book, God, Government, and the Road to Tyranny, free advertisement for my buddy here, you write that homosexuality should be outlawed and that we must never forget God's warning to Israel that homosexuality will define a nation as set forth in Leviticus 18. I'm working very hard to preserve equal rights for gays, legality of homosexuality, and even to achieve gay marriage. By working towards these ends, am I violating an absolute moral value? And if not, why not?
Yeah, first thing I'd like to say is thanks for noting my book. And it's on sale out there. But I was kind of vague there. I wasn't as constitutional as I have become since writing that book. I was moving in the direction of constitutionalism. So I actually have a lot of problems with the Christian right in this country. And I don't think that sexuality is a federal issue. So I actually believe that issues like homosexuality should be dealt with either on the state level or the local level. And at one time we had 50 state, you know, anti-sodomy laws. Right now there's a few left and nobody's enforcing them. I would imagine that I would expect a country that gets further and further away from biblical Christianity will probably have laws that reflect that. And so basically what I would say is I, in my local community or in my state, I would argue against it. But I would expect that as I become a minority, then I would expect that the morality of our nation, the laws of our nation, would reflect the worldview. So basically I think it's wrong, and I think it's not conducive to a healthy society, but I think it should be handled as either a state or a local issue. And so, I mean, if you're fighting, if you think differently and you're fighting for that issue and you think it's right, that's a whole other thing. My issue with you is not your stance on homosexuality, though I would disagree with you. My issue with you is your stance on God, and that's what the debate's about tonight.
On page 75 of the same book, you write that the attempt to empty one's mind as practiced in Eastern meditation leaves a person vulnerable to demonic possession. Can you prove this claim?